Thinking about the talk yesterday, I decided that I was really trying to answer two questions. One of them is, what should you do in your professional life if you want the world to be better? And the other is, how can the legal system make it in your interest to do it? And I start with what economists call the coordination problem. In order to do almost anything in a complicated society, you need to somehow coordinate the activities of an enormous number of people. The standard example is making a pencil. To make a pencil, you need wood. To cut down trees for wood, you need chainsaws. For chainsaws, you need steel and gasoline and copper. For steel, you need iron ore. For iron ore, you need mine workers and mining machinery. Somehow, you have to set things up so that there are enough mine workers trained to dig enough ore, to make enough iron and steel for enough chainsaws to cut down the number of trees you need for the number of pencils you want to make, and ditto through the entire economy. So if you think about it for a while, your first conclusion should be that we should all be dead, because this is too hard a problem to solve. If you're trying to think about coordinating hundreds of millions of people in an interdependent system. And there are basically two solutions to the coordination problem. The obvious solution is centralized authority. The obvious solution is hierarchy. You have somebody at the top who decides what everybody should do and tells them all to do it. And that works on a very small scale, but it scales very badly, because as the number of people involved gets larger, you get more and more layers, as it were, between the manager and the factory floor. It is harder for him to know what people should do. It is harder for him to see whether they're doing it. And it is less and less likely that his interests will be the same as the interests of the people who he's supposed to be working for. So that system works very badly on a large scale, as I think the Soviet Union, as among a number of other countries, have demonstrated. The alternative is decentralized coordination. And the idea of decentralized coordination is you somehow set up the system so that each person is solving a small part of the problem, and yet somehow in his solution to it, he's taking account of the effects on everybody else. And that sounds impossible, but in fact, a market with prices and private property doesn't do it perfectly, but it does come surprisingly closer to that result than you might expect. And the basic logic of it is that if you are producing something, you have to buy your inputs, because one of the rules of that system is that you don't get to seize things. You've got to get them from willing sellers. That means you've got to give the producers of the inputs as much as it costs them to produce them, or as much as they would value consuming them themselves. You produce outputs. So that means that the cost of your inputs is being transferred to you in the price you have to pay. You can think of prices as a signaling system in this vast coordinated system. You produce an output. You sell your output to willing buyers. That means that what you're getting transfers to you the benefit of what you're producing. If you then maximize your profit, the difference between your revenue and your costs, that means that you are maximizing the benefit to you after taking account of the costs of everybody else and the benefits to everybody else, because they're the people who are providing your inputs or consuming your outputs. And that's the basic logic. That's a very short version of about a semester or two of price theory. If any of you don't want to go to university to learn it, I've written a book called Hidden Order, which is an attempt to teach the same things to people who are reading the book for fun. My inspiration was a book on evolutionary biology, The Selfish Gene, which I read for fun. And the next step, however, is that most of you are not going to be individual traders on the market buying and selling and producing. You are presumably, most of you are or will be, probably both, executives, employees in a firm. So the question is, how do we transfer this elegant decentralized coordination system from an economy which is only individuals to an economy made up largely of firms. That the way I sometimes put it is the capitalist beach is made up of socialist grains of sand. That is, if you think of a single firm, it's like a miniature socialist economy. It's a more or less hierarchical. Real firms have internal markets as well, but largely a hierarchical system. And why does that happen? And the answer was provided by Ronald Coase, who argued that both decentralized and centralized coordination have their costs. That the costs of the centralized model, I've really touched on already, the difficulty of figuring out what people should do, knowing what they're doing. The costs of the decentralized one are transaction costs, that in order to get your inputs, you've got to find somebody who's selling them, you've got to bargain with him over the price, you've got to inspect the quality, and so forth. So there are costs to both of them, and some things it makes more sense to do in-house because you avoid the costs of the marketing, the transaction fees. The others it makes more sense to buy on the market. And the natural equilibrium is that a firm grows, pulls more things in-house, up to the point where pulling one more thing in-house raises the costs associated with the problems of hierarchical coordination by more than it lowers the costs associated with market transaction. And that was one of the two articles for which Coase really got the Nobel Prize and deserved it. I don't remember what the title is, but it's basically the theory of the firm. So in that case, how do you fit that structure into the decentralized solution? And the answer is that the firm, like the individual, has both costs and benefits transmitted to it through prices, that the firm has to buy its inputs, it's got to pay you people enough so you'd rather work for it rather than for anybody else, which means that it's not harming you by employing you. It may even be benefiting you if you're lucky, and so forth. Everybody except the stockholders is being disciplined, as it were, by the market. That is to say, the firm is required to take into account its interests of its customers in order to get them to buy. It's got to take into account the interests of its employees in order to get them to work for it. It does not automatically have to take into account the interests of the stockholders, because the buyer can buy from another firm. The workers can work for another firm. But the stockholders can only sell their stock if someone is willing to buy it. So it's rather as if your deal as an employee was you could only quit if you found a substitute. And if you think about the logic of that, if the firm is acting in a way which does not maximize the benefit to the stockholders, if, for example, the firm is spending any money at all, in a sense, that doesn't provide some revenue or reduce some cost, then the result is that once people can tell that it's not maximizing profit, that result is already capitalized into the stock price. That the stock price, if the firm, imagine an extreme case where the CEO starts converting firm revenue to his own pocket. He buys himself mansions and things, a fully corrupt system. He can't steal from his customers because customers will go somewhere else. He can't steal from his workers for very long because they'll go somewhere else. But he can steal from his stockholders because the stockholders can only sell if somebody else will buy. And the buyer already knows that the firm is not maximizing profits and therefore is willing to offer him a low price. So that's the basic argument, as I see it, for the principle that's referred to as stockholder primacy, the idea that the job of the executive is to maximize the stock price, which he does by maximizing profit in a complicated sense where it's not just profit today, but the present value of the expected value of all future profits. And now, I'm exaggerating a little bit because the market doesn't perfectly reflect the interests of the customers. For example, I am a customer of Apple Computer. If Apple decided to raise the price of their computers tenfold, I would probably stop buying them. And that would be a real cost to me. I mean, I might have to learn Unix. I gather there are varieties of Unix that are pretty close to an Apple interface. So I've got, as it were, certain sunk costs in learning to use that product. So it doesn't perfectly work. And similarly for the employees. If you have been working for a company for 20 years, you've spent time and effort learning how to navigate that company, acquiring skills particularly useful for that, and so forth. So I am not describing a perfect system. There aren't any perfect systems. But you, the employees, and you, the customers, have a recourse that the stockholders don't really have. And therefore, I would argue that the right thing for the executives to do, since we're describing, remember, this started out with how do you coordinate people so as to maximize total value. And again, this is another semester, at least, of price theory, what that means and so forth. But we're talking at a fairly low level at this point, necessarily, because I've only got 30 minutes. And so now, next question is, what legal rules make this work? And the obvious ones are, the obvious ones are the normal rules of a market, namely voluntary transactions, the fact that you can only hire somebody who's willing to be hired. This is not entirely true in our society. I got my jury notice this week, but then there is a small element of slavery even in a free society, unfortunately. But at least for private firms, they can only hire you. The government can all, the army can also hire you if you don't want to be hired, but it's not doing that at the moment, fortunately. So that's one rule, voluntary interaction. And the second rule, which is a legal rule in our system, at least traditionally has been, is stockholder primacy. That in principle, a stockholder can sue the executives if they're doing things that benefit them but not him. However, there's a problem with that, and the problem is an enforcement problem. Because although it may be obvious if the CEO is taking all of the revenue and buying himself mansions and fancy dinners and such, it's not going to be that obvious if he is reasonably clever and does things which he can argue are in the interest of the firm. And it's true that he paid a lot of money to a consultant, and maybe that consultant has some other connections with him that we don't know about. So it is relatively hard for the legal system to actually enforce the rule that the executives are agents of the stockholders and have duties as a result. There is, however, a different way of enforcing it, and this is a way which is very unpopular with executives, and that's called a takeover bid. That imagine that you are running your firm in a way which a sufficiently clever observer can realize is only making its stock worth half as much as it should be. If the sufficiently clever observer has access to enough money, he buys stock in your firm at its depressed price based on your present performance. When he gets enough stock in the firm, he uses that stock to vote out the board of directors. His new board of directors puts in his choice of executives who then run the firm properly. If he's right, after a while, other people observe the firm is now making more money. Therefore, its stock goes up. Therefore, he can sell the stock that he bought at a large profit, and he now has money that can be used for another takeover bid. Currently, the U.S. legal system discourages this. That in particular, if you are engaged in this activity, you are supposed to publicly announce that you're accumulating stock for a takeover bid at a point when you've gotten much less than 50%. It's not my field of law, so I don't know exactly what the rules are, but there are that, and in various other ways, the legal system discourages it. And my argument is that this is a serious mistake, that we would like to have a system where takeover bids are relatively easy, because the takeover bid is a way of disciplining the executives of a company. It's a way of making sure that they are acting in the way which maximizes shareholder value. Now, like all things, it's imperfect. And you will certainly hear stories, especially from the executives of companies that are threatened with takeover bids, that they're only doing it because they believe the stock market has very short-run views and doesn't take account of the fact that we're losing money at the moment, but we're going to make money in another 10 or 20 years and so forth and so on. It's possible. But on the whole, people who are willing to risk their own money in a takeover bid are more likely, are a better mechanism, I think, for estimating future value, and in fact, the stock market is a better mechanism for estimating future value than any others that we have available. And therefore, I'm arguing that this is, in fact, a mechanism that we should facilitate rather than block. Now, what are the alternative arguments? What are the arguments against stockholder primacy? I'm going to forget about my takeover bids for the moment. And just take, why might people think that executives should do something else? And I think there are basically two arguments that I have considered. One of them is that executives should make their decisions for the good of society rather than the profit maximizing of their company. And that, if that's done in a sophisticated way, people start with the various ways in which the market solution is imperfect, and then say, all right, well, if you, the executive, realize that the market system does not take account of the cost of increasing CO2 in the atmosphere and therefore causing climate change, then in that case, you, the CEO, should sacrifice some revenue in order to do things in ways that won't create CO2 or will create less CO2. And you can think of lots of other versions of that story. But versions of the story which say in some way, there is some way in which a dollar expenditure could produce, as it were, more than a dollar of benefit, and you should do that. And there are two problems with that. The first is the executive does not really know what is in the good of society. I've got a whole bunch of Substack posts, which I'm in the process of turning into a book, arguing that while indeed it is true that increasing CO2 causes climate change, it's not at all clear that climate change is a bad thing, that the current orthodoxy basically depends on looking at all of the negative effects and none of the positive effects. And for people who have been in cold climates, there are certainly positive effects to weather getting warmer. And it turns out there are a bunch of other positive effects. And as far as I can tell, if you really look at the question carefully, we just don't know. That you're talking about effects over a long time period of time, and we cannot tell. I think, at least, that we cannot tell whether the net effect is good or bad. But there's an orthodoxy. You will be unpopular if you don't express that opinion. I don't mind being unpopular. And therefore, if you are an executive, you might decide to act in that way. And there are lots of other cases. But that in general, I've just been arguing that the coordination problem is a hard problem. But in effect, the executive is claiming that he can do the centralized solution all by himself. All he has to do is to look at the world and see that if only more money was spent in this way, things would be better. And I'm arguing that for that complicated problem, although it's certainly possible that he's right, and I certainly have no objection if he wants to donate his own money for the purpose, that he is now spending the stockholders' money for his guess of what's good. Furthermore, it's not at all clear that he will be spending it for even his guess of what's good, because executives, like the rest of us, tend to act in their own interest. And it is easy enough to persuade other people and even to persuade yourself that something that you are really doing because it benefits you is for the good of the world. And my imaginary example is the executive who gets his company to donate money to the local opera. And the result, of course, is to raise his status in the local community of the kind of people that go to opera, who are basically high-income people like him, at the cost of his of other people. So that's one argument. The other argument is one that is put in terms of stakeholders. And one of my colleagues at the law school was a strong proponent of this. He was a bright guy. I don't know if I ever persuaded him that he was wrong. But his argument is that while stockholders indeed benefit or lose by what the company does, so do customers and so do employees. And that therefore, you, in addition to the stockholders having a vote for the board, the customers and the employees ought to have their people on the board as well. And I think I have already shown why that's a bad argument, because it is not the interest of the customers and the employees is not in the long run net effects of the actions of the company. It's in the effects on them. So if you could imagine, for example, a board member who represents the employees, he would perfectly reasonably say, let's raise everybody's wages, and as long as this doesn't result in the company going bankrupt before my present employees retire, that's clearly in interest of the employees, and we have no reason to consider effects beyond that. And from the standpoint of the customers could say, you should be lowering your prices, you should be modifying the product in ways that we like, but that cost more than they're worth, and so forth and so on. So in either case, the stockholders are the only people who are, as it were, locked in permanently, even though you can sell your stock, but it's permanent because the price you can sell it for depends on what other people who buy it think the future performance of the company is going to be. So that's my basic story. I'm arguing that indeed the traditional doctrine of profit maximizing companies, where profit has to be defined in a complicated way, enough way to recognize that you may take losses this year in order to make gains next year, 5 years from now, is the right rule for how executives ought to act in the public interest, as it were, in the general interest, and that because neither executives nor anybody else can be trusted to act in the general interest, that we want a legal system in which it is in their interest to do so, and the way we do that is by not preventing takeover bids. There are probably other mechanisms as well, but that's the one I thought about. So that's really what I had to say. I think it's probably less than 30 minutes.